You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Some truths in the Bible seem very backward. Like God lays out a take on things, we hear God's wisdom and it sounds strange. Like, how could that be true? And yet God says it is true. Counterintuitive truths in the Bible. There's quite a few of them. When I think about this, it reminds me of when we tried to install, we did install, one of those narrow dog doors that goes in your back patio door. Our dog Jake was always barking to go out, so we were like, let's get a dog door. And this was the kind with the flap. And you just, you know, the dog pushes through and they can go outside, they can come back in, they can do whatever they want. And the problem with this is when we got this, and it's understandable, just look at it. If you're a dog, what does that door look like? It looks like a wall, right? The idea that he could just walk through a wall to freedom. Counterintuitive concept. Very difficult to help our dog Jake realize, no, actually, that's not a wall. That's a door to a complete new way of life where you can go in and out whenever you want. Well, anyhow, this is the way it is. So many different things in the Bible are puzzling. It's like, how could God see things this way? God actually explains in Isaiah why this is. Why is God's wisdom so often backward? God says, my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. And all God is saying is, I've got this unique perch. I'm sitting in a place that you can't really understand. I relate to time and space in ways no human can appreciate. And from this special perch that I have, I often see things that you miss. Yeah, maybe this illustration would help. Imagine you'd never seen Script, Ohio, okay? Never been to the game, never seen it on TV. And somebody just plopped you down on the field in the middle of Script, Ohio, just unfolding. What would that be like for you? It would be bewildering, right? There'd be people spinning and strutting and swinging their instruments and, you know, just everywhere you look. Like, what is going on? It would be bewildering to be on the plane of the field watching this unfold in the middle of it all. But if you could back up, right, and be in a different perch, a different perspective, you could instantly see, oh, that's not chaos. This is a precision maneuver where they're spelling out Ohio. But it really would depend on your perspective on what's unfolding. And this is why it is really true when we look at the Bible, God sees things that we miss. He understands concepts that you could never get unless he broke into your reality and said, this is the way it really is. These backward truths. And in our passage here, one little bit of God's wisdom, a very counterintuitive bit of wisdom that we're going to look into, is this concept that true power is found in weakness. True power. Power like you've never experienced, found in weakness. I realize, you know, there's people here, there are people here, who are in a lot of pain, who have been feeling pretty weak for a while. You've tried this and tried that, it's not working really well. The notion that, you know, you're at the end of yourself, it feels that way. It feels like you're facing a wall, you know, like you're kind of being boxed in a cul-de-sac and there really is no next step. And in this message, in this passage is, that may be how you see it. And there's no doubt that you're reacting to something real. The marching band is right in front of you and it is bewildering. But from where God sits, what might look like a wall to you could be a door to freedom. Could be a door to a new quality of life that you've never experienced before. And so what about that? Well, Paul gets into his story here just, you know, to kind of walk into how this works, this principle works in his life. He says, whatever they dare to boast about, I'm talking like a fool again, I dare to boast about it too. I love how sassy, all the way through this part of Corinthians, Paul's just super sassy all the way through. The they he's referring to are these false teachers who are undermining people's faith in Jesus, who are putting themselves out as super apostles, and basically turning the tables on Paul and saying, you're the one who's unqualified. Who are you to even talk about God? And so Paul is finding himself in this awkward place where he's got to boast. He actually has to talk about his qualifications as an authentic apostle, a true spokesman of God. Why he's the person who is qualified to let people in on what God really says. And so he gets into a little boasting here, but you could tell all the way through he's not really excited about doing this. At first, honestly, it seems like he's reacting to these criticisms the way most of us would. You know, somebody criticizes me, you're on my case about something. I want to respond to you point by point and just crush everything that you're saying about me. And that's how Paul starts. Real muscular defense. You know, one of the false teachers' accusations is that Paul, you know, I don't know, his mom, his dad, his mixed Jewish background, they challenged his Jewish credentials. He responds and says, well, are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they descendants of Abraham? So am I. He's like, you know, I studied under Gamaliel. I was one of the leading Jewish scholars when I was in Jerusalem. If there was a Jew out there, I'm your guy. Unabashedly saying, look, this is not where my resume is weak. Another thing that, and this is preposterous, that they were saying, the false teachers were saying, is that he's not a committed servant. You know, he just kind of rolls in here and he's trying to just bilk you guys. Paul's like, all right. And so he just lets it fly in response. He's like, are they servants of Christ? I know I sound like a madman, but I've served him far more. I've worked harder, been put in prison more often, been whipped times without number, faced death again and again, 5 different times. The Jewish leaders gave me 39 lashes. That's one short of death at 40. 3 times I was beaten. Once I was stoned with rocks. 3 times I was shipwrecked. I spent a whole night and a day adrift at sea. He's like, I've traveled on many long journeys. I've faced danger from rivers, from robbers, danger from my own people, the Jews, as well as from the Gentiles. He's like, if it's been something you could do to suffer for Christ, I've done it, right? I've faced danger in the cities, in the deserts, on the seas, danger from men who claim to be believers but are not. I've worked hard and long, enduring many sleepless nights. I've been hungry and thirsty. I've gone without food. I've shivered in the cold without enough clothing to keep me warm. Remember at the end of one of his letters, remember what he says? Don't forget to bring me my cloak. Sounds like he needed it. Then, of course, besides all this, I have the daily burden of my concern for all the churches. Who's weak without my feeling that weakness? Who's led astray? And it doesn't make me get upset with anger. Okay, so he just goes off on this whole riff about why, yes, of course, I'm qualified. I can imagine, like, the false teachers at Corinth, as this part of his letters being read out loud to the congregation, they're like staring at their shoes, like, wow, okay, he's got a point. He's an authentic servant. But even after making this compelling case about his Jewish credentials, even after putting out there, yeah, I've paid my dues as a servant, he catches his breath in the midst of his defense, and he says, If I got to boast, though, honestly, after saying all this, if you're going to make me boast, I would much rather boast about the things that show how weak I am. I'm a Jew of Jews, a Hebrew of Hebrews. I've been there and I've done that, but you want to know the most compelling thing about me? The thing that I feel the best about? The thing that maybe gives me the most hope? The force multiplier when I think about what it means to serve Christ? He's like, it's my awareness of my weakness. That's what I would highlight, he says, on my resume. Then he goes on a little bit further. He's like, the God, Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, is worthy of praise. He knows I'm not lying. He's like, look, everything I've said is true. He throws out one more story. When I was in Damascus, the governor under King Aretas kept guards at the city gates to catch me. They actually had to lower me in a basket through a window on the city wall to escape from him. He's like, I am the Indiana Jones of the early church, okay? I mean, he's like, just a show of hands, who here has been lowered over a wall in a basket to escape your enemies in the service of Jesus? I'm just curious. Anybody? Nobody. Nobody. So, you know, this is like, in math, they call this quod erat demonstratum. Okay, the case is rested. The proof has been established. His critics are full of it. But he wants to be thorough. So he puts out one more credential. He's like, you know, my best attribute, you think it's all these things, and yeah, I can check every one of those boxes. My best attribute is weakness, but if you really want to put me on the ropes, let me give you one more thing, one more credential. He says, this boasting, this is not good. You could just say, he'd like to peel his skin off. He feels really uncomfortable about doing this. But I must go on, he says. I will reluctantly tell about visions and revelations from the Lord. This was a big thing with his critics. You know, authentic spokesmen of God, they have these powerful visions and revelations. And Paul's like, you know what? I've got that covered too. He says in verse 2, describing this criteria, he says, oh yeah, I was caught up into the third heaven 14 years ago. I'm not going to take 20 minutes to talk about what in the world he's talking about. I really don't know. But he had this experience, still remembers it. Whether I was in my body or out of my body, I don't know. Only God knows. Yes, only God knows whether I was in my body or outside my body, but I know that I was caught up into paradise. I heard things so astounding that they can't be expressed in words. I'm not even allowed to talk about it. Have I had a vision? Oh, yes, I have. And it's funny, though, if you just pause and look at the way he, again, as he talks about this credential, this is the only place in the Bible he talks about this. You get the sense he didn't like to talk about it very much. In fact, in some of your translations, you'll read this, and it's in the third person, where he says, like, I know a man who. That's the way it's laid out in Greek. And it's almost like Paul's like, there's this experience, and like he's taking a step over here just to put a little distance between himself and what he's describing. And what are we supposed to pick up from that? He's telling you, this is not something I would feature on my resume. You know, when we're having the battle of the ultimate servants of God, and we're talking about Jewish credentials and how much we've gone through and how many visions we've had, he's like, you know, I don't even see the need to talk about this. Why is that? You know, I've had some of these experiences, not the paradise, third heaven type stuff, but I mean, some of you have too. You're reading the Bible, get some time in the morning with your cup of coffee, and some verse just hits you between the eyes like it never has before. It's like that part of the page is radio, or your phone or whatever, is just radioactive. You could tell God really wanted me to drink in that truth. Or, you know, you're praying with people. And you can just tell. We can just palpably sense God's love. He's here with us. Paul doesn't disparage this experience. He remembers, it's been 20 years. He treasured this experience. But as awesome as it was, he's like, that's not what I would put on my servant of God resume. Why is that? Well, it's because there is something that Paul thinks soars above this, soars above all these other things that he's been laying out. Something that is so crucial, you will never know what it's like to be fully empowered and used by God unless you get it. And he tells us in the next verse what it is. He's like, you know, that experience, wow, it was cool, worth boasting about, but I'm not going to do it. It's funny because he kind of already has, but anyhow, he's like, enough of that. He says, I'm going to boast about my weaknesses. Oh, there it is again. He's like, if you're going to give me a minute or two to talk about something that's really my best feature, you know, there's a lot to talk about, but I'll tell you, the thing I would highlight is this awareness of my weakness. Now, Paul was, he was a great scholar, powerful, dynamic leader. I mean, he planted churches on multiple continents, trained some of the most effective leaders. We're sitting here today in large part because of the team that this man led in his service of Christ and the ongoing impact of their work. One of the most influential people in human history, you could argue, next to Jesus Christ. And he's saying, you know what I get excited about when I think about what really sets my life on fire? It's my awareness of my weakness. Now, where did that insight come from? Is it that Paul, the scholar and dynamic leader, was able to, you know, unlike us, he was able to zero in and get this? I don't think so. Paul was on the field. He's a human, locked in flatland, right? Same limited perspective that you and I have about what's really true. And God himself had to break into Paul's life and intervene so that Paul could see what he could not see without God's help. And that is that it's our weakness that may be the very best thing we have going for us. And I know that might, if you're hurting and feeling painfully aware of your weakness, that might feel like a heartless thing to say. God's wisdom often does seem that way. And yet, Paul's asserting, no, it's true. Weakness, awareness of that may be the best thing you have going for you. How is it that Paul came to terms with this counterintuitive truth? Well, he's like, if I wanted to boast, I'd be no fool in doing so, because I'd be telling the truth. He's like, human comparison-wise, I have a lot to talk about, but I'm not going to do it because I don't want anyone to give me credit beyond what they can see in my life or hear my message, even though I've received such wonderful revelations. So to keep me from becoming proud, he says, I was given a thorn in my flesh. Interesting. A messenger from Satan to torment me and keep me from becoming proud. What a bizarre passage. There's some weird stuff in that last verse there. We've got pride, which that's the easiest part of this. Pride is the resume building that Paul's been so reluctant to be forced to talk about, right? The thorn in the flesh, that's a related concept. With pride, there is that kind of padding your resume with what you've done and experienced. And apparently, God saw that trajectory in Paul's life. He saw a danger of that, that Paul might go that way. And so, to mitigate what could have been a really bad direction in Paul's life, he let him experience this thorn in the flesh. Now, what was it? Honestly, we're not sure. This is one of the most hotly debated topics in this book. We know it was probably a physical ailment, because when he says, thorn in my flesh, sarx, he is almost certainly talking about his physical body. Like, there was just something happening with his body. What was it? At this time in his life, it could have been possibly something to do with his eyes. We know for sure it was very uncomfortable. The word he uses for thorn is sclopas. It's not a little blackberry pricker. We're talking about one of those big 2-inch-long thorns that are connected to trees. Something painfully, physically disruptive. That's what this is, more than likely. Sent by Satan. Yeah, I'd love to spend 20 minutes on that, but I'm not going to. I'm not going to say much about it, other than Satan wanted to demoralize Paul, I'm sure, and somehow was involved in this happening. Maybe we can talk about it during Q&A. Was it an eye infection? Maybe. It's interesting, around this time, actually a little before this time, Paul describes having this malady that was hard to look at that would have moved the Galatians to literally scoop their eyes out to help him. Like maybe he had some kind of oozing eye pus infection. It even says at the end of Galatians, he's like, look at these big letters I'm using as I write this document. Like he's like oozing on the parchment and trying to write out what he's... And you know, he's... The thing is, here's the thing. Whatever it was, it doesn't really matter. And maybe it's helpful that we don't know what it was. This is the purpose it served. And this is the purpose that a thorn in your life will serve. The purpose it served was to confront Paul with his weakness. Yeah, his weakness. God let this happen so that Paul had to just face his weakness. He reacted just like you and I would. You know, when you're battling an illness or you've got some situation at work and you've got to make money and this is the job you got to go to, but it's just every day it sucks. And, you know, our reaction when we feel like we're in a vice like that is make it stop now. And that is his first honest reaction is, you know, 3 times I told God, take this out of my life. And I just think we should pause here to just acknowledge it's okay to tell God, I'm hurting and I want it to end. Not my life to end, but this pain to end. Right? It's okay to tell God, this is really painful. I don't know if I can keep going. I can think of some things I went through. We had a child that didn't wind up making it back in 2000 and went pretty far into the pregnancy and kept getting updates. He's got a heart condition. Oh, he's got this and this. And the feeling of there's someone there that I deeply love and I can't do anything about it. God, I'm, you know, waking up every day thinking of, you know, that kind of stuff. You're just like, make that go away. And sometimes God does make it go away. It's a reasonable thing to ask. Paul saw God heal people. Paul saw God do incredible acts of healing through him. So why not ask? Many times when we do ask that God would make it stop or help us with our thorn, his answer is yes, and he will. But sometimes the answer is no, I won't. And that was the case with Paul. What's unique about Paul's situation is the answer was no. The answer was no, but God supplied an explanation along with the no. That's something we don't get very often. Every time Paul pleaded with God, take this thorn away, God said, my grace is all you need. My power works best in weakness. See, this is the heartbeat of this whole section that we're studying. Weakness. My power works best in weakness. Paul, I know what you're thinking. You think this thorn makes you feel powerless, that this is it. But I'm telling you, through this, you will experience my power. There's something in this for you that's better than being delivered from it, Paul. In great weakness, you can find strength. And I wonder, as you're sitting here, and maybe you're in the middle of some kind of thorn, I wonder if that's your perspective. It does seem counterintuitive, especially in the middle of something like this, that this, though it seems like a wall, might actually be a door to freedom, that there might be something about this that's going to teach me something about relating to God that will turn me on to experiencing the power of God in a way I could not otherwise experience. Are you open to that possibility? This is a real fork in the road for Paul, and it's a big fork in the road for many Christians. How am I going to relate to this persisting weakness, this thorn that I'm experiencing? You know, one route would be to say, well, you know, am I going to blame this for why everything I try to do for God doesn't seem like it's going well because I'm in the middle of this difficult thing? Is it going to be the reason I conclude my days of effective service are over? Is that how I'm going to relate to this? Will I go on strike until my weakness goes away? Is that what it's going to be? You know, these are all supernatural responses. I've walked all the way down this list. The thing is, when we want to hang up our cleats and walk off the field, when we kind of get that settled sense, that can metastasize into unbelief. This is part of why people just decide to check out, is because it has to do with the way they relate to these types of experiences. What would be the alternative? The alternative would be to, in faith, even while you feel like you're bleeding, to at least be open to the idea that this is a door to something new and maybe good. Back to my story about Jake the dog. We couldn't get Jake to use the dog door. It was like virtually impossible. We'd like push him through. We'd put him there. We'd put food on the other side of the door. Like, can't you smell that? Go for it. We even finally hooked a leash up to him, threaded it through the door. I'm in the back patio pulling him like I'm reeling a fish in through the door. He's like yelping and complaining. It was a dark passage in his life to learn how to use that door. But imagine, he finally got it. And imagine, you know, the dog mind, like, I'm outside. And I finally, like, look, I can go out and in. You know, that moment of like, wow, I get it. So I don't know how it felt to be him to get it, but wow, it had to feel really good. And Paul has some kind of weird breakthrough experience like that, that he goes on to talk about. You know, the thorn didn't go away, as far as we know. But Paul says, each time he said, here's what you get, my grace, my power works at best in weakness, Paul came to terms with that. Isn't that interesting? He just said, okay. That's crazy. And it says, as he moved on and he kept following God and he started to see things, he landed here. I'm glad to boast about my weaknesses so that the power of Christ can work through me. That's why I take pleasure in my weaknesses and in the insults and hardships and persecutions and troubles that I suffer for Christ. He's like, he's kind of like Jake. He's like, I get it. When I'm weak, I'm strong. This is a really important experience in his life. And so all the components of this backward wisdom of God, they're all here in this passage. There's the pride piece, right? How our inborn, you know, natural trajectory is to look to self, to look to our resume, to look to our strength, instead of depending on God. Every one of us battles with this. There's the thorns, plural. It's interesting. Paul broadens the whole concept. Maybe it was a physical malady for him, but look at how he broadens it. There's weaknesses. You know, you got to walk 20 miles to get to the next town to preach, and you know, you're 12 miles in, and you're hungry and tired. And you got physical limit. You're trying to stay up late to talk to somebody at home church, and all you can think of is, I just want to go to bed. The insults, just being stung, and you know, like you feel like you've just been put in your place, lost all credibility with anyone you'd want to influence. The hardships, hostile people that hate Christianity, that want to take you out. They don't care how they're going to do it. Troubles, you know, just all that crazy headaches and unexpected. You know, I just found out my daughter's old bedroom, her window is leaking. And so now, and this is kind of what trouble, the word trouble refers to being put in a narrow space with limited options that you don't want to be in. I got a leaky window. I've got wet drywall. I got to call a contractor. I got to rip out and see what the damage. There's all. I don't want to do any of that, and I don't want to spend any money. But that's that. That's part of it. And I got to fit that into everything else I'm doing. All right, so he's like, we've got our thorns. We've got our pride. We've got our thorns. And then we have this discovery that as demanding as these thorns can be, if we relate to them properly, we can learn this powerful truth: when I'm weak, I'm strong. And so where does that leave us? What are the implications here? I was trying to think of a good way to illustrate this insight that would really help. This is from Watchman Nee. He describes an episode where he's swimming with some buddies on a river. This is in Alabama. I just put it up there. His story is from China. But anyhow, he says, a group of us were swimming in a nearby river. So Watchman Nee, this famous church leader in China. One of my brothers, swimming out in deep water, got a cramp in his leg. He was visibly struggling to stay afloat. He was in distress and sinking. I quickly motioned to another brother, an expert swimmer, who was swimming only several meters away, to hasten to his rescue. To my astonishment, this guy hadn't moved. This expert swimmer is just kind of watching this guy struggle and flail in the water. Had not moved. Growing desperate, I yelled out, "Don't you see the man is drowning?" But our expert swimmer still didn't move. Calm and collected, he remained just where he was, apparently postponing this unwelcome task. Meanwhile, the drowning brother's voice grew fainter as his energy was depleting. In my heart, I said, "I hate that man. Why does he not save him from his struggle and respond to his calling?" But when the man was actually sinking, with a few swift strokes, the expert swimmer was by his side, and in no time they were safely ashore. And when it was all over, Nee says, I walked over to that guy. I said, "I've never seen anyone so selfish and love his life as much as you do. Think of the distress you would have saved your brother if you'd considered your needs above your own." But the expert swimmer knew his task better than I understood. He remarked, "Had I gone earlier, he would have clutched me so fast we would have both gone under and drowned." And this is the kicker. A drowning man can't be saved unless he ceases to be frantic and is utterly exhausted, and then he's able to be saved. For rescue to happen, for God to be able to rescue us many times and bring us to another place, a better place, we do have to reach the end of ourselves. And getting there sucks, right? Reliance on God, which is where real power comes from, because it's God working through us. That's what matters. Reliance on God can begin when dependence on self ends. And there's something about these thorns that are a crucial piece of that. So what does it mean? One obvious implication, so basic here, is that if we can admit our weakness, if we can see it, we can receive salvation. You know, you think about the human experience and everything we can go through. The most powerful thing a human being could ever experience is to be saved, to receive the life of God, to be given eternal life, to have your whole future change in a moment. That is the most powerful thing anyone could experience. But to experience it, it requires an admission of weakness. There has to be this willingness to come to terms with the fact that we are sinful, that we don't just hurt ourselves, we hurt other people. We offend God's righteous character. We do things that basically communicate we want to live our life on our terms, our way, and that creates this yawning chasm, an unbridgeable chasm between us and God, a chasm we could never cross. We could never just find our way over and reunite with God. It's never going to happen that way. Too much water under the bridge, too much living, too much sinning, too much culpability to ever restore that fracture. And it's hard, it's un-PC, it sounds so culturally out of step, but the Bible demands, God demands, that we own up to that we own up to our weakness. And then, I mean, that's most of the battle. Then look what Ephesians says. God, he's willing to save you. He saved you by his grace. That's a gift. When you believed. And you can't take credit for this. This is nothing you could ever generate or earn. This is something that weak, desperate people receive with open hands. We can't take credit for this. It's a gift from God. It's not a reward for good things that you've done. If you've been told you've got to be good enough works, no. We have to be honest about our weakness and call out to God. Why? Why is it that way? So that no one can boast. This isn't something to put on your resume. This is something to receive because you see that you're weak. Have you ever done that? Have you ever just told God, I agree with you that I'm weak and I want to receive this gift of salvation I could never earn? That's a key implication of this powerful, counterintuitive principle. Here's another thing, too. You can't predict someone's impact based solely on their natural strengths. You just can't. You know, I was thinking, this is a pretty big church. It's a pretty big room full of people. Over the years, there are some people sitting here, some of us here, are going to do amazing things in our service of God. So I don't know who or how, but there are individuals here whose ministry will touch thousands of lives. And how would we ever predict who that is? How could we ever like size up, you know, who's the likely shooting star that God uses in a super powerful way? Well, we couldn't do it by just using human standards to analyze people. That's Paul's whole point all through this letter. He's telling the Corinthians, dudes, you are looking at things outwardly. Quit thinking that way. He says about the false teachers, they measure themselves by themselves, compare themselves with themselves, and they're without understanding. It's just that the whole premise is wrong. What he argues is no, it's people that are aware that they're weak. People that see that the gorilla in the room, the power that matters, is not coming from here, it's coming from God. Those are the people that God's going to use. You know, you think about this truism. You know, we are raised in a culture that says true power is rooted in human strength that we can see. God says true power comes when he works through our weakness. That's really the two opposing views here. Think about the early church. Paul said it was composed of a lot of poor, uneducated people, lots of slaves primarily. By the end of the first century, that beleaguered group of people had led 1 million people to faith in Christ. Why is that? It was because God worked through their weakness to do something amazing. You guys ever heard of D.L. Moody? D.L. Moody was the Billy Graham of the 1800s. And he came to Christ in the back of a shoe store. And he was kind of a country bumpkin, didn't talk real good, but he was a dynamic speaker, not educated formally, and actually got invited to go speak at Oxford and Cambridge, you know, the most eminent institutions of learning in the world at that time. And he didn't want to go. He was worried, I'm going to show up there and I'm going to start preaching and people are going to make fun of the way I talk. But he decided, I'll do it. He shows up, starts talking, and sure enough, a bunch of people in the front row are mocking everything he's saying. Because he's just like, yeah, I won't tell you about Jesus. You know, and he's just, people just thought he was ridiculous. An unlikely effective spokesman, but he stayed for a week. And if you read the accounts of that time that he was there, the whole campus was turned upside down. Hundreds of people wound up coming to Christ. Some of the most influential opinion leaders, athletes, scholars in these universities wound up selling everything they had and going overseas to be missionaries. And they would trace their transformation back to this series of meetings at Oxford and Cambridge. They're called the Cambridge Seven, if you want to read about them. And that's just because why? God totally digs using weak people. The better, the weaker, because if you're weak, then it's clearly God's power that's working through you, right? He chooses what's foolish to shame the wise, what's weak to shame the strong, what's low and despised, things that are not to reduce to nothing, things that are so that what? Oh, there it is again. So that no one might boast in the presence of God. This is how God loves to work. This is why anyone who can grasp this basic idea, the best thing you have going for you is this awareness of weakness, man, that opens the door to a lot of awesome things in your life. I'd say, just to wrap up here, God is ready to meet you in your weakness. I worry sometimes in talks like this, we're just steamrolling right past how people feel. I've heard talks like this when I'm in pain, and it's hard to hear a talk like this. I get it. I think a key insight to realize as you're hearing this is that God is with the brokenhearted. That's David's insight. He's like, you know, when you are feeling like you're at the end of yourself, that's a space that God is present in. He saves those who are crushed in spirit. And that's what Paul, remember he said, the key part of God's message is, hey, my grace is sufficient. What is God's grace? It's a lot of these things. That's just a snippet. It's that I can take any tough situation and do something good with it. I'll never leave you. You've got an afterlife filled with things that you couldn't even conceive of. I'm going to open your mind to the word in ways you could never get on your own. There are all these unmerited gifts. In that moment of weakness, God stands ready to give us. And yeah, that's part of it. It's just realizing God's present here and he's ready to offer these things right now. Maybe you felt like God's been tugging at you, you know, like, hey, come on, I know you're in pain, but come on. You ever get that sense? You just feel like God's been kind of tapping on your shoulder and you're like, I'm just going to gut this out. I'm okay. I'm just going to wait till this passes. Back to the same old, that's what I'm comfortable with. And God's like, no. You know, David got this, you know, the Lord said, seek my face. He's like, Lord, when you said, seek my face, my heart said, your face, O Lord, I shall seek. Well, you know what? I don't always feel like that. I don't feel like responding to God like that. But if you can do it, if you can tell God, all right, okay, I know you're trying to get my attention, then we can follow follow Paul as a model. You can just let it rip. Let God know how you feel. That's what we see Paul doing. You can affirm. You know, I don't feel like it. I don't know how this is going to work out. I affirm, Lord, that you have the strength I need, that you're going to walk through this door with me. that you're present in this and that you've got the strength I need to learn through this. And I also, this is just common sense, but a lot of times the very people that we're rebuffing because we're in so much pain we want to be isolated are people God has deputized to come and minister to us. And so just realizing a lot of God's love and care for you is coming from people in your life that are trying to help. So here's just a final quote on this. I think this is a good summary of what we've talked about. James Stewart, he says, "It's always upon human weakness, not on human strength, that God chooses to build his kingdom. And he can do this not merely in spite of our ordinariness and helplessness and infirmities, but precisely because of them. It's a thrilling discovery to make, and it can revolutionize your outlook." So, okay. Here you go. That's 2 Corinthians chapter 12. Lord, thanks for folks trying to work through this. This is really, really a tough, very tough counterintuitive truth. And thank you that you're patient with us as we try to work through this. We can learn it and forget it too. That's a possibility, Lord. We can't change the fact that in this world there's tribulation. That's our universal experience. But what we can do, Lord, is relate to it in a way that's beneficial, where we walk through these things with you and learn this new strength that you want to give us. So I just pray you'd be with each person here, whatever they're going through, as they just try to keep trusting you and moving forward like we see Paul doing through this passage in his life, God. Amen.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.